I titled my sermon this morning, "This Bud's for You." Children are like taters. I have a whole bag of them to illustrate, but I've already laid them out of the bag because it'd be a little awkward to put them up on the podium. So, let's see. We have the new taters, like Robert Joseph Winchell and Simon Luna. And Megan Langton and Cassidy Kling and Cordell Meikle. And we have some sweet taters. Like Sarah Henry and Christina Langton and my daughter. There are many varieties of potatoes. I didn't realize how many varieties there were until I started doing, putting the sermon together. Everybody knows Idahos have dark brown skin and white to yellow flesh and a more or less oval shape like this one. But there are other ones. One's called Ruby Lou's, and this isn't a Ruby Lou, but you can imagine one that's even pinker than this. Hot pink skin and a white flesh and an oval shape. There's another one called a Desiree, and it has a pink skin too, yellow flesh, and a long oval shape. There are Carlingfords that have a plain white skin, white flesh, and an oval shape. Delawares, they have a creamy skin and white flesh and an oval shape. Kestrels have a white skin, blue eyes, cream-colored flesh, and a long oval shape. Kipflers have pale yellow skin, yellow flesh, and an elongated shape. And then there's the thing called the Royal Blues. They have an almost purple skin, yellow flesh, and a long oval shape. And russets, of course, have that ruddy red color you expect to see. You get the picture. There's lots of varieties when it comes to potatoes. And children are like potatoes, too. Some of them are more pleasant than others. Let's see. There's the cogitator. Mom, why is the sky blue? Mom, how do car engines work? Mom, how do fireflies light up? Imagine what it would have been like to be Albert Einstein's mother. There's the agitator. What mother hasn't heard this question a million times from the backseat of the car? Mom, when are we going to get there? Cogitator has that special knack of poking and prodding his brothers and sisters until they make you want to explode. Let's see. There's the dictator. That's the big brassy brother who, just by his tenure, knows all of the rules of the game and thinks he was placed there to keep all of his subordinates in line. There's the irritator. That's the bristly kid who has more spines than a porcupine, rubbing everybody exactly the wrong way. And then we have, of course, the imitator, the one who annoys everybody else by crying when she cries after the same manner as her brothers or sisters. Stand up. Get over there next to your brother. Actually, the imitator is an alien kid from outer space. And they come to us in so many different ways. Why, raw. When everyone first gets their kids, they're all raw material. Some of us get kids who are half-baked. Some of them are French fries. Chrissy used to say some very interesting things. She said, mew, mew, for the cat, and the cat talked. French fries, kids are French fries, especially after a whole day at Six Flags. And they come with ketchup, without ketchup, with mayonnaise, vinegar, you name it. But when it comes to cleaning the rooms, all kids are hash browns. And sometimes they come this way. Sometimes you want them this way, especially after a long day, mashed. I think it's exceptionally telling that it's the tater flakes that get mashed, don't you? Okay, so why am I getting all those blank stares? You're not with me? These things don't happen at your house? Okay. Now let's all open our Bibles to Proverbs 31, and you You perfect housewives and moms can verify that you've still got it all together. You can pick up that sweet potato home fry kid in the back and go home, and we'll honor you again next year. Hey, wait a minute, not so fast. I know there's at least one frazzled mom out there who could use some advice from you moms to have everything wired together. Right, Elizabeth? This year, I thought we'd serve up something other than the normal McDonald's French fry sermon on Proverbs 31. You know, biblical fast food. Let's review the marks of the perfect housewife and mom. She tirelessly gets up before dawn every morning and sets everything in order. She's a wizard in the kitchen, an expert weaver and seamstress, a skilled grocer, a master of real estate, a vine dresser, a weightlifter, you know, the gal at Bally's who's always girding her loins with strength and strengthening her arms. She has time to give handouts to the poor and to the needy. She's a master decorator, making tapestries for herself and clothing herself in purple silk. And she makes fine linen and sells it from the back of her minivan. She makes belts and delivers them to merchants at the mall. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and she eateth not the bread of idleness. Does this sound like anyone you know? Doesn't sound like it to me. To me, it sounds more like all of the women in our congregation put together, more than one woman in particular. And the reason for that is in Proverbs 31, is the prophetic advice of King Lemuel's mother to her son about the attributes an ideal wife would have. Take a look at verse 1. The words of King Lemuel, the prophecy that his mother taught him. Talk to a wise mom, and she'll tell you that this is quite a list. Who is that ideal wife? Can any one woman live all these different lives and have all of these skills? I don't think so. This is a prophecy on two different planes. At the literal level, it was addressing some of the practical needs that a woman should meet in order to make her man successful. The old adage, behind every good man, there's a great woman. It's really true. It's clear here that King Lemuel's mother was not thinking about the attributes of a particular woman. Rather, she was selecting the individual skills of the great women that she knew. As I read the list, I think of the many mothers that have touched my life in various ways and at various times. I think of Elizabeth's grandmother, Harriet Yonker. She was an expert seamstress. She frequently was called on to make bridal gowns for young ladies in the Bradford, Pennsylvania area. And she even made the bridesmaids' dresses for our wedding. For fun, she made all kinds of other clothing, like pajamas. She made pajamas for Robert and his cousins that Chrissy is now enjoying. And she even made my pajamas from the time my husband and I got married right till the time she died. Chrissy now wears all the hand-me-downs from her cousins. I think of Elizabeth's mom. Diane Simmons is a wonderful Christian woman. She's a mother to 4 great kids and a grandmother to 6 kids. She's a wonderful cook, and she keeps a beautiful house in northwestern Pennsylvania. She works really hard to make her home as peaceful a place as any on earth, and I appreciate every moment I get to spend there. No matter how harried I feel here, when we go home to Elizabeth's mother's house, I'm instantly relaxed and at ease. I think of my mom's mom, Jeanne d'Arc Prue. Mémé, as we called her, always had a sharp tongue that belied her warm heart. She had one way of raising her kids, all 7 of them, with an iron fist. There was one way of doing things, her way, the right way, and if you don't like what's for dinner, there's a restaurant down the street, she used to say. I remember her sternly reproving my grumbling aunts and uncles hanging out around her kitchen in anticipation of her wholesome meals. I think of my dad's mom, Juliana Yanchishin Millie. Grandma was an awesome cook. I remember watching her cook as a child about Robert's age. She lovingly shredded the cabbage to dice it and make the filling for her homemade pierogies, which came in the traditional Ukrainian styles, cabbage, potato, and prune. And they were boiled and then fried to crispy perfection. Yeah, she grew rhubarb in her backyard, and I remember she introduced me to my first grapefruit and to my first rhubarb pie. I remember her cutting off the stalks and blanching the rhubarb on the way to making her pie for dinner. I think of my own mother, Marie Rose Milley, and all the hours and hours she used to work to ensure our house was always spotless, despite the five kids, two or more cats, and usually my occasional snakes, turtles, fish, lizards, etc. I remember coming home from school at least once a month to find that all the kitchen furniture, except the table, was in the family room. And those days were barricaded off from the rest of the house until the wax dried on the kitchen floor. Mom is still a very devout Catholic, and I learned a lot about the value of hard work from her godly example. When I look at the characteristics of a Proverbs 31 mother, though, I think of many of you mothers here at Cornerstone as well. My wife Elizabeth is nearly always first up in our house. She's a skilled wizard in the kitchen, a magnificent baker of bread, a skilled purchaser of groceries. She always knows when the best prices are to be found for everything that we use. She spends hours working with Robert on his homeschooling and playing with Chrissy, and then pours what little free time she has in developing the Sunday school curriculum and the vacation Bible school curriculum. I think of Jody Vanderford tooling around in her white minivan, a master real estate saleswoman and a lady who really has a heart for ministering to other busy ladies. I think of Beth Henry, tirelessly tutoring other children in math and witnessing to others through her craft club and book club and reaching the youth of our congregation through the youth group. I think of Rebecca Winchell's skill as an artist and designer. She's got a great eye for decor, and I've come to appreciate her input and counsel to our church council in her role as deaconess. I think of Linda Smith and her great skill in weaving baskets that Longaberger can't hold a candle to. She keeps a lovely house, too. I think of Deborah Makel and her self-sacrificing homeschooling of her five children, being active in the Constitution Party and still finding time to develop an umbrella school ministry for Cornerstone. I think of Tanya Kearns upholding the truth of Christ in her workplace amongst the lost and backbiting busybodies that she's had to endure, and the personal battles that she's had with her back and the physical trauma that she's endured, like the three car accidents they've been through recently. I think of Loretta Gamble and how proud she must be of Becky as she's turned into such a great wife to Pepe and mother to Simon. I think of her patient witnessing to the people she cares for at the hospital and her tender and willing submission to the Holy Spirit, her obedience and her sacrifice, and I think of her support to the church council, first as secretary and now as hospitality chair. All of our church dinners are nicer because of the time that she puts into planning the little details that are arranged between herself and Linda Smith and Pat Amstutz. And I think of Pat and all the trials that she's had recently to go through in Germany. She's still recovering from being so ill. All the things that she's done in Ken's life and in the life of their girls. I think of her gift of hospitality when I reflect on all the little extra details that she puts into hosting whenever the refreshments are there at the service. I think of Sharon Makel moving into the first house that she could call her very own and struggling to bring up two very different teenage boys by herself, giving them the best possible life that she can. I think of Cheryl Battles bringing up Emily by herself and her commitment to the unborn. I think of Martina Langton, and I'm awed by her ability to grasp not only English, but also of her ability to learn all of the U.S. Army vernacular and to grasp all the U.S. laws on how things work. Did you know that she and Jay are looking into homeschooling in Washington State? If you think it's difficult doing it here, imagine coming from a country where it's illegal to homeschool your children. I'd say Martinez made a few adjustments, wouldn't you? You see, each of you have your own path to walk. Each of you have been given exactly the right challenges to make you into what God wants you to be. But he would be cruel if he gave you a seemingly insurmountable task without giving you what you need to get there. Corrie Ten Boom's father was very wise. Corrie once asked him about things that he felt were too difficult for a child. He was a watchmaker and had an extremely heavy toolbox. He asked Corrie when they went to travel by train, when did he give her a ticket? She said, just before we get on the train. He said, with God, it's the same way. He gives us just what we need when we need it. He asked her if she could lift his toolbox. She said, no, it's too heavy. He said, so are some ideas too heavy for little girls to pick up, and too heavy for her to worry about. God has given each of you unique skills. He's brought you to your current place in life in His perfect timing. Some of you are wondering this morning, what is God going to do next? What is the excitement of the Christian faith? We do not need to worry about where our next meal is coming from or what God is going to do with our entire life. He only requires us to be in submission to Him moment by moment, day by day. Trust Him for your tomorrow and give Him your today. He'll give you the ticket when you need it and not before, and He'll carry the toolbox until you can. You see, on the higher level, the Proverbs 31 prophecy wasn't meant to discourage you as moms. It was designed to draw the body of Christ closer together. God gives each of us skills, and He's given us gifts to make us dependent upon one another so that we will be a well-rounded bride, one who is skilled and ready for the marriage supper at the Lamb. When you first take them from the ground, potatoes are dirty. They're covered in mud. Is God there in washing your kids every night? Can He relate to that? Can He relate to the sore, cracked, and chapped hands of the toilet training mom? Can He relate to dirty dishes? Can He relate to the never finished laundry? Can He relate to dirty dishes? Can He relate to the never ending questions? Can He relate to the dirty dishes? How can it be when God seems so far away, so well removed from all the dirty diapers of the little new potatoes of this world? Yes, He does care. Not only does He care, but He shows us very clearly in His Word many ways in which He can directly relate to raising taters. God knows what your good days are like. When was the last time your children made you to dance and weep for joy? As a young man marries a maiden, so will your sons marry you. As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. Isaiah 62:5. The root word for the word translated rejoice here in Hebrew means to be glad greatly, joy, or to make mirth. So how does God relate to mothers of newborns? Being available 24 hours a day, dropping everything to take care of that newborn baby's cry. In Psalms 110, verse 4, the Lord says, Thou, referring to Jesus, art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was the king of Salem in the area surrounding what's now Jerusalem and the West Bank. And in Genesis 14:18, Melchizedek met up with Abraham and presented him with bread and wine. Jesus is always interceding before our Heavenly Father on our behalf, just the way you care for a newborn baby's needs. Newborn babies are completely helpless. In Exodus 14, God protected His fledgling nation from an advancing Egyptian army using a pillar of cloud to separate His people from Pharaoh's. The people couldn't defend themselves at all. All they could do was listen, obey, and run away. How does God relate to mothers of toddlers? Well, just about every toddler enters that terrible two stage and they become disobedient. In Genesis chapter 3, we have Adam and Eve eating the forbidden fruit. I'd say He can relate to disobedience. Exodus 32. While Moses was up on Mount Sinai, what were the rest of the Israelites doing? Well, Aaron, his brother, second in command, is down collecting earrings from everybody to make a golden calf to worship. And they had just gotten the first set of tablets, and they just didn't understand it. Moses came down, he was so angry he broke the tablets and took God Himself to give him another set. You know, God had to teach the Israelites where to bep, That's an interesting word. It's a great word. It's a Robertism, my son, for anything dirty or muddy, and it refers to bodily movements too. Toilet training. In Deuteronomy 23, verses 12 and 13, God told them, "You have to have a you are to have a place outside the camp where you can go when you need to relieve yourselves. Carry a stick as part of your equipment so that when you have a bowel movement, you can dig a hole and cover it up." And that's exactly how it reads in the NIV. So God had to teach them how to bep and where to do it outside the camp. Have you ever had to tell your kids over and over and over to behave themselves? Well, God does, starting in Genesis 3 in the garden. In Exodus 20, he gives us the Ten Commandments. In Leviticus, he gave them dietary and social laws. In Numbers, Deuteronomy, Judges, etc., 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 he keeps telling them how to behave and what do they keep doing, misbehaving. Confidence. In Exodus 14, 26 to 31, the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen." And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea at daybreak, and the sea went back to its original place, and the Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and the horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea, and not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through on dry ground with the wall of water on their right and on their left. That day the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. And when Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. But then a few days later, what are they doing? They're whining about not having anything to eat. The God that just delivered them from the Egyptian army through a miracle of water, walls of water. Exodus 16:3, the Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into the desert to starve this entire assembly to death." And in the very next chapter, Exodus 17:3, we hear the people thirsty for water. And they grumbled against Moses and they said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" Are your kids fussy eaters? Numbers 11, 5, and 6. "We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. But now we've lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna." Here they have the God of the universe providing for them bread from the frost of the earth, and they can complain about it. How does God relate to the mother of grade schoolers? Do your grade schoolers have disputes? God can relate to your desire for harmony in your family. After all, he lived through Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau, and Jacob's 12 sons. In Genesis 37:4, we see Joseph's brothers grow jealous of Jacob's attention to love him, and so they plot against him. And you know the story. He gets thrown in the well and then sold off by the slave traders to Egypt. In Genesis 42, six chapters later, the brothers are desperately in need of grain, and the only grain they can get is from Pharaoh's stores, and guess who's in charge of that? You know it, Joseph. Over the next three chapters, God reveals a loving story of how the family was restored and reunited until in Genesis 45, verse 1, Joseph cannot stand keeping his brothers in suspense any longer. You see, God had done something so amazing in his life that he just can't wait to share it with his brothers in verse 3. "I am Joseph! Doth my father yet live?" And in verse 5, says, "Don't be afraid, I'm not angry, for God sent me to preserve life." All the lives of his people of Israel that were saved because God took Joseph and put him into his position. God cares about the disputes in our families and wants to see those relationships corrected and maintained. Poor memories. Mommy, where did I put my... What do you mean you told me to clean my room three times? In Genesis 3, 45 and 48, Jacob took up a stone and set it up as a pillar. And he said to his relatives, gather some stones. So they took stones and piled them together in a heap, and they ate there by the heap. And Laban called it Jegar Sahadutha, and Jacob called it Galid. Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me today. That is why it was called Galid. It was also called Mizpah, because he said, may the Lord keep watch between you and me while we are away from each other. God cares about our memory and wants our kids to have good memories. How about kids' bossiness? The Pharisees were certainly bossy. They're like older brothers or dictator here, trying to lay down the law to their siblings, or their underlings, as they like to think of them. How about kids' forgetfulness? In Matthew 14, 17 through 21, Jesus fed 5,000 people using five loaves and two fish, and there were 12 baskets left over. But just a short time later, in Matthew 15, 33, the apostles are imploring Jesus to send the people away so they can buy food. With seven loaves and a bread and a few fish, he fed another 4,000, and there's seven baskets left over. And they still didn't get it. Your kids forget. So do the apostles. They couldn't remember that he could do all these kind of miracles. The kids not remembering you've done this all before. You bandaged a knee. You're thinking, oh, it's going to hurt, Mommy. I know it's going to hurt. Did it hurt the last time you fixed it? Probably not. Or at least it wasn't quite as bad because it was you that was fixing it. How about disbelief? Disbelief even in Jesus' own brothers and sisters. In John 7, verses 3 through 5, Jesus' brother said to him, you ought to leave here and go to Judea so that your disciples may see the miracles that you do. No one wants you to become a public figure. No one who wants to become a public figure, rather, acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, you should show yourself to the world. For even his own brothers did not believe in him. And Jesus and his 12 apostles in Matthew 20:20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. What is it you want? He asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right hand and the other at your left in your kingdom. And later, again, they were jockeying for that all-important right-hand seat. Obedience. Telling people over and over and over again, God tells them, don't worship Baal, don't worship Astarte, worship me. How does God relate to parents of teenagers? Do you have to deal with arguing? In Mark 9, 33 and 34, it reads, they came to Capernaum when he was in the house, and he asked them, what were you arguing about on the road? But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. How about vacillating maturity? Are your kids really striving out one moment and backsliding and regressing the next? Well, Peter was that way. In Matthew 16, 15 and 16, he said, but what about you? Jesus asked. Who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter answered, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. But just a short five verses later, in verse 21, from time to time, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day raised to life. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said. "That shall never happen to you." Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." You ever get interrupted? In John 6:16-24, Jesus was getting interrupted. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were terrified. But he said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. The next day, the crowd that had stayed on the opposite shore of the lake realized that there was only one boat that had been there, and that Jesus had not entered it with his disciples, but that they had gone away alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got in the boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. Do you have a desire for a relationship with your child, but everyone else is too busy? Jesus had to walk on water in order to catch up with his disciples, as we saw earlier. And there were times that Jesus went off by himself to fast and to pray and to spend time with his Father. Do your kids not do as they're told? God's kids didn't. Not driving out the Canaanite clans in Judges 1:27-33. But Manasseh did not drive out the people of Beth-shan, or Taanach, or Dor, or Iblim, or Megiddo, and their surrounding settlements, for the Canaanites were determined to live in the land. When Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, but the Canaanites continued to live among them. Neither did Zebulun drive out the Canaanites living in Kitron or Nahal, who remained among them, but they subjected them to do forced labor. Nor did Asher drive out those living in Akko or Sidon or Aleb or Akzib or Helabah or Aphek or Rahab. And because of this, the people of Asher lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. Neither did Naphtali drive out those living in Beth Shemesh or Beth Anath. But the Naphtalites, too, lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land, and those living in Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath became forced laborers for them. And this is very significant, because this disobedience has forced them, the descendants of those Canaanites are now the Arab people, the Palestinians, that they have to live with in the West Bank and the Gaza and the Golan. They didn't obey, and they're still paying for the consequences. In 1 Samuel 15:10-26, Saul didn't obey God's instructions for the battle, and he tried to blame his soldiers. The result? He lost his kingship. This is the very lesson that Beth Henry is teaching our children this morning in Sunday school. Seeing the pain of your kids making the wrong choice and loving them enough to let them learn their lessons by suffering the consequences and empathizing with them. God does empathize with you. How about insolence? Numbers 20:2-13. Now there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron, and they quarreled with Moses and said, "If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert, that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink." Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance tent, the tent of meeting, and fell down, face down. And the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And the Lord said to Moses, take the staff that you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You'll bring the water out of the rock for the community so that they and their livestock can drink. Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he had commanded him. And he and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? And then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with the staff. Water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. But that's not what God told them to do. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them. These were the waters of Meribah, where the Israelites quarreled with the Lord, and he showed them himself holy among them. You see, Moses, if he had been not insolent, he would have just listened and spoke to the rock as God had told him to. Instead, he himself was not permitted to enter the promised land. Okay, the one everyone dreads. Driver's ed. Does God relate to mothers who have kids in driver's ed? I think so. In Matthew 10:1, we have the closest thing I think Jesus ever did to his apostles as far as driver's ed goes. He called his 12 disciples to him and gave them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and sickness. These are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, who was called Peter, and his brother Andrew, James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. Do not go among the Gentiles or enter any town of the Samaritans. Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel. As you go, preach this message. The kingdom of heaven is near. Heal the sick and raise the dead. Cleanse those who have leprosy and drive out demons. Freely you have received. Freely give. Do not take along gold or silver or copper in your belts. Take you no bag for the journey, no extra tunic or sandals or staff, for the worker is worth his keep. Whatever town or village you enter, search for some worthy person and stay there at his house until you leave. As you enter a home, give it your greeting. If the home is deserving, let your peace rest on it. If it is not, let your peace return to you. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake the dust off your feet when you leave that home or town. I tell you the truth, it will be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. I am sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore be as shrewd as snakes and innocent as doves. Be on your guard against men. They will hand you over to the local councils and flog you in the synagogue. On my account, you will be brought before the governors and kings, witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. But when they arrest you, do not worry about what to say or how to say it. At that time, you will be given what to say. For it will be not you speaking, but the Spirit the Father is speaking through you. Brother will betray brother unto death, and a father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. All men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. When you are persecuted in one place, flee to another. I tell you the truth, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. A student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It's not enough for the student to be like his teacher and the servant to be like his master. If the head of the house has been called Beelzebub, how much more the members of his household? So do not be afraid of them. There is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed or hidden that will not be made known. What I tell you in the dark, speak in the daylight. What is whispered in your ear, proclaim from the rooftops. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both the soul and the body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of the Father. And even the very hairs of your head are numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. Whoever acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge him before my Father in heaven. But whoever disowns me before men, I will disown him before my Father in heaven. Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household. Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives the one who sent me. Anyone who receives a prophet because he is a prophet will receive a prophet's reward, and anyone who receives a righteous man because he is righteous will receive a righteous man's reward. And if anyone gives a cup of cold water to one of these little ones because he's my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will certainly not lose his reward. So it's with a lot of instruction. And who hasn't sat through a lot of driver ed classes and movies and instruction? And then you have to get behind the wheel, right? He sent them out. And they went out, and Jesus went off and prayed by himself to his Father and took some time of rest. And then they had a report back. In verse 14, when they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. What are you arguing with them about? He asked. A man in the crowd answered, Teacher, I brought you my son, who is possessed by a spirit and has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. Oh, unbelieving generation, Jesus replied. How long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. So they brought him, and when the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the boy's father, How long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him, but if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can, Jesus said. Everything is possible for him who believes. Immediately, the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me to overcome my unbelief. When Jesus saw the crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the evil spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up to his feet, and he stood up. After Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, Why couldn't we drive it out? He replied, This kind can only come out by prayer. So they failed their driver's test. Who hasn't failed at least once in something? Finally, I want you to see how Jesus took care of his own mother, even in one of the most trying times of her life, while he was dying on the cross. In John 19:25-27, we read, Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother, his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Cleopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, Dear woman, here is your son. And to the disciple, Here is your mother. From that time on, this disciple took her into his home. Jesus only spoke 7 times while he was on the cross. And these words were so important to him that he endured agony and struggled to get a deep enough breath to speak them. You see, it was important to Jesus to see to it that Mary was taken care of, especially in the Jewish culture, where it was customary for the eldest male child to care for his elderly parents. Well, it's certainly true that Jesus also knew that John would be spared martyrdom and would be able to care for her longer than any other. I don't think that was the reason he chose John to care for her. I think it's because he loved John, and he knew that compared to the others, John would best fit his mother's needs. It's not that it was a matter of her being without support. It's each of the Gospels record Jesus' mother and brothers coming to visit him. In Matthew, it's at Matthew 12:46-50, and we read, "While Jesus was still talking to the crowd, his mother and brothers stood outside wanting to speak to him. Someone told him, 'Your mother and brothers are standing outside wanting to speak with you.' And he replied to him, 'Who is my mother and who are my brothers?' Pointing to his disciples, he said, 'Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of the Father in heaven is my brother and my sister and my mother.'" In Mark, the same passage is found in chapter 3, verses 32-35. In Luke, the passage is found in chapter 8, verses 19-21. So Mary had other children who could have taken care of her. Furthermore, her sister is also recorded as being there at the cross, but the Son of the Living God of the universe empathized with her loss. He comforted her, even while his own life, the one she was grieving, was ebbing away. What is there then that God cannot relate to in your life this morning? Are some of you thinking for the first time that maybe God really is alive? That he really does relate to you? That he understands what it is to face dirty dishes day in and day out? What is the state of your relationship with the loving, living God of the universe? How is your walk with Christ this morning? If you do not have a personal relationship with the one who understands everything that you're going through, let me encourage you to begin that relationship today. We began this morning singing the church's one foundation. Are you set on that foundation? Do you have a personal relationship with the one who understands everything you're going through? If you'd like to have a relationship with Jesus Christ, please come and see me immediately following the service to find out how you can begin a relationship with Jesus today. Perhaps this is the first time you've thought about how important the relationship between children and their mothers is to God. What is the relationship you have with your own mother at this moment? Is it broken? What is the relationship you have with your own children this morning? Is it bruised? Perhaps you've had some minor fallings out over things that don't really matter at all compared to Jesus' example. Jesus, close to his last dying breath, ensured his mother would have financial and personal security for the remainder of her earthly life. He took a moment out of rescuing the whole universe from its sin in order to care for that relationship. Shouldn't you take care of yours? If there's a broken relationship in your life, you need to mend it today. Don't put it off till tomorrow.